from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, 21 people are reported dead after a typhoon strikes the Philippines. U.S. Defense Chief Chuck Hagel tells American troops in Afghanistan they still have challenges to meet. Chinese teachers protest against low wages. And Americans remember the attack on Pearl Harbor. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The Philippine Red Cross says at least 21 people have been killed since a powerful typhoon hit the island nation. Red Cross Secretary General Gwendolyn Pang said today that at least 18 of the victims died on the eastern island of Samar, where Typhoon Hagupit made landfall late Saturday. The latest death toll came as the capital, Manila, braced for the arrival of what is now a tropical storm as it continues to slowly move through the Philippines. Schools have been suspended. The stock market is closed. Many office and government workers have been told to stay at home, and dozens of commercial flights have been canceled. Forecasters say Hagupit, which was moving northwesterly at only 10 kilometers an hour, may take 3 days to cross the central Philippines. Authorities say this typhoon does not appear as destructive as last year's typhoon Haiyan, in part because of a massive operation that evacuated nearly a million people from coastal landslide-prone areas. Typhoon Haiyan killed more than 7,300 people and brought some of the strongest winds ever recorded on land. Thousands of victims of Haiyan are still living in tents a year after it took roughly the same path as the current typhoon. Over the last few weeks, thousands of teachers went on strike across northeastern China, protesting low pay and forced contributions to their pension plans. Shannon Van Sant reports from Beijing.
A mass strike by teachers in northeastern China ended last week. It was one of several that rapidly spread through towns and cities in recent weeks. Teachers say they were protesting low wages. One teacher said she just wanted to raise her salary. She said she was not comparing her salary with others. She just wanted the salary she deserves. Teaching in China has long been a profession that garners relatively low pay, but the recent strikes in Heilongjiang province were rooted in a government plan that requires teachers to contribute to their pension plans, something government workers had not been asked to do in the past. For some teachers who say they earned as little as $160 a month, $400 for those with much experience, it was too much. Their protest intensified and spread to half a dozen cities near Harbin beginning in mid-November. Protesters marched on government buildings, and classes in some places were suspended. Zhang Lifan is a Chinese expert and historian. He said China's education system has long been too harsh on teachers, and the strike is a result of built-up resentments. Teachers' strikes have also erupted in other parts of China this year. In October, teachers at a Guangdong Province junior high school also protested over low pay. And earlier, teachers at a high school in Hubei protested their status in the public employment system, which determines their pension plans. Jeffrey Krauthall is head of communications at China Labor Bulletin in Hong Kong.
Teachers have been going on strike for a while now, but in the last couple of months, we've definitely seen a spike in action amongst teachers across the whole country. We've recorded at least 30 strikes in the last 3 months. And it's mainly teachers who are working in less developed areas of China.
While such worker strikes in the past would have received little attention, Krauthall says the prevalence of social media has helped protests spread quickly from city to city.
Because of the development and spread of social media in China, all of these incidents are, the news of these strikes is readily available to anybody who has a mobile phone. And so teachers are fully aware that their colleagues in other parts of China are taking action, and it's bringing positive results for them. Some teachers have got a pay raise, albeit a small one, out of this.
The teachers' strikes ended, at least temporarily, last week after the government said it was reviewing their demands. As Krauthal said, some protests have already been successful in forcing higher pay. In Heilongjiang's Jiaodong City, authorities have increased teachers' monthly pay by an average of $135. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
North Korea has denied any responsibility for last week's cyber attack on Sony Corporation's Hollywood studio, although it acknowledged it may have been the work of pro-regime supporters. A group called Guardians of Peace has taken responsibility for the attack. According to Bloomberg News, the hackers used the computer network of the St. Regis Hotel in Bangkok Tuesday, December 2nd, to leak confidential Sony data to the Internet. According to a person familiar with the investigation of the hacking, who spoke on condition of anonymity, the private details of thousands of Sony employees, former employees, and freelancers, as well as several Hollywood stars, has heralded a dangerous new era in cybersecurity. Sony executives, the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, and Homeland Security are all conducting probes into the attack and say it is too early to blame anyone. Sony is preparing Christmas Day to release The Interview, a comedy film about two journalists recruited by the Central Intelligence Agency to assassinate North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Pyongyang has strongly denounced the movie as an act of terrorism and war. Cedric Layton, a former U.S. Air Force intelligence officer and now head of his own risk management consultancy, Layton Associates, told VOA's Victor Beatty, "This cyber attack underscores North Korea's triple threat of conventional and nuclear, chemical, biological, as well as cyber warfare capabilities."
My assessment is that these people really knew what they were looking for and were bent on wreaking havoc within the Sony community and also damaging Sony's business. And it seems to me that, as with other cyber experts, I see it as a very well-organized attack. I also see it as a precursor to other things that can happen. North Korea is very capable of doing this. They rank among the top 10 cyber powers in the world. And what that means basically is that they have both an offensive and somewhat of a defensive capability. Their orientation is most certainly in the offensive mode. And what they do is they have at least two units that are associated within their governmental structure, within their military structure, that are associated with cyber warfare. One of those units is known as Unit 121, and that is based in North Korea itself. The other unit, which is probably affiliated with Unit 121, is actually based in China. And they may have used the Chinese organization to launch this attack, and that then gives them the plausible deniability that they can use against any stories that come out saying that North Korea did this. They can say, well, it wasn't us, but really what it was another unit that is working at their behest with full knowledge and full understanding of the North Korean government.
So if I understand you correctly, North Korea could have contracted this cyber attack out to a well-organized group.
I would say instead of contracting out, they had an affiliate, in essence, that operates outside of North Korea. They have in the past used China as a base for operations of this type, and they may be doing so without the direct knowledge of the Chinese government. But certainly they have a degree of understanding of what the networks are that they need to penetrate or that they feel they need to penetrate, and that is what they do. They use this as a vector of attack, and it's, in essence, another way for them to wage asymmetric warfare.
Earlier this year, five People's Liberation Army personnel were implicated in a cyber attack on U.S. Private as well as public installations. Has North Korean personnel ever been implicated in a similar type of operation?
No, they have not, at least not publicly, and they certainly have not been the subject of any indictments by the Department of Justice. North Korea has been busily at work honing its cyber warfare capabilities. They've done so underneath the radar. They have not publicized any of this, and nor have any of their activities been revealed in the mainstream press. Some people in the government have been aware of activities that the North Koreans have mounted or have possibly mounted in the cyber domain, but nobody within North Korea has ever been charged with any crimes pertaining to cyber activity, nor has cyber warfare reached the level that merited a public U.S. response. And that's in essence the difference between the Chinese case and or cases in this case and the North Korean situation. In essence, it's a matter of degree. It's a matter of the threshold that each country has reached in the cyber warfare realm. And that's what we're seeing here.
Layton says there are allegations that Sony employees have been physically threatened in this attack, taking it to a whole new level of cyber terrorism. On Sunday, Americans remembered the December 7, 1941 attack on the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by the Imperial Japanese Navy. Five U.S. battleships sank or were severely damaged. Several hundred warplanes were destroyed, and more than 2,400 people died on that day. It was the most devastating foreign attack on U.S. soil until the 2001 terrorist attacks. Here is VOA's Faith Lapidus.
Historian Craig Shirley was born more than a decade after the end of World War II. But he says the war was ever present as he grew up.
I grew up in a family and in a culture where the point of reference for everybody in conversation was before the war, during the war, or after the war. And everybody in my family had been involved directly in the war effort, whether it was civilian or military.
President Franklin Delano Roosevelt had resisted joining the war in Europe. He had been reelected to a third term. The nation was gradually climbing out of the Great Depression.
Franklin Roosevelt made public speeches to American mothers saying, "I'm not going to send your boys to fight in a European war."
But all that changed on December 7, 1941, when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. In his book, December 1941, 31 Days That Changed America and Saved the World, Shirley dedicates each chapter to a day, starting on December 1st. On December 8th, FDR addressed a joint session of Congress with his famous speech that began,
"Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan."
Everything stopped at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and everybody gathered around their radios in their homes, in their libraries, in their churches. There were radio repair stores all over America that had radios out front of their stores and would have them on for passersby to listen to. The stock market closed. Everybody stopped to listen to the President of the United States.
40 minutes later, Congress declared war against Japan. On December 11th, Germany declared war on the U.S., and America joined the battle.
It was more of a, well, I guess we've got to get into this over there after all.
Going to war, Shirley says, changed America.
Women built airplanes and tanks. They learned how to become firefighters.
The nation's capital changed overnight.
Tens of thousands of civilians and military personnel come into the city. New buildings spring up every place. All the federal buildings have machine gun nests on top of them. There are Navy and Marine armed guards stationed at the entrance to every federal building in Washington, the Capitol, the White House, the State Department.
While Craig Shirley focuses mostly on what happened in the United States, another book gives an international perspective, focusing on 12 days only.
The 12 days are really pivotal in terms of the war as a whole and in the 20th century as well.
Evan Maudsley is a history professor at the University of Glasgow. He wrote December 1941, 12 days that began a world war.
In fact, the Japanese attacked the British before they attacked Pearl Harbor by about half an hour when they attacked Malaya. And the reason why they attacked Pearl Harbor is because they want to make sure the American Navy can't intervene in their invasion of Malaya.
Maudsley says the world after December 7th became fundamentally different from the world just one day before.
America as a global power, the real beginning of that, I think, does date back to the shock of Pearl Harbor. And up until this time, the whole fate of the world is determined by European powers. And from the first days of December, all of a sudden, the way the world operates has become global. You could argue, I think, that globalization almost dates back to this period of time.
Maudsley shows that December 1941 is not only still relevant, it indeed changed the world. For writer Faiza El Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News, Washington.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Departing U.S. Defense Chief Chuck Hagel has told the remaining American troops in Afghanistan that they still have challenges to meet, even as their mission soon will shift from fighting Taliban insurgents to training Afghan troops. Mr. Hagel, who recently resigned, made a final stop in Afghanistan Sunday, telling U.S. troops at a base near the eastern city of Jalalabad that the job's not over. The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in October of 2001 to overthrow the Taliban regime that harbored al-Qaeda fighters responsible for the terrorist attacks on the U.S. a month before. The U.S. and its NATO partners are withdrawing most of their troops from Afghanistan by year-end, leaving 12,500 American military personnel to train their Afghan counterparts. Secretary Hagel said Sunday, ultimately, no matter what the extent of U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq, people in both countries must take responsibility for their own fate.
Our role is different in Iraq as it is here. In the end, each country must take the responsibility for their own future.
Outgoing U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel. A 10th doctor in Sierra Leone has died of Ebola. Isle Solomon Kono Yima's death occurred late Saturday at an Ebola treatment center in Hastings, near Freetown, and came a day after two of his colleagues also died of the deadly virus. It is another blow to a fragile health system still recovering after a decade-long civil war in the 1990s. It is believed Sierra Leone had just one doctor for every 50,000 people in 2010, about 120 physicians in the entire West African country. Saturday, the government announced two other doctors had died of Ebola. 11 doctors have been infected and only one has survived. In better news, Cuban doctor Felix Valles, who contracted Ebola in Sierra Leone, has returned home to Cuba, cured after 16 days in a Geneva, Switzerland hospital, where he received experimental treatments. The World Food Program and the British military have been airdropping food by helicopter to residents of Sherbro Island and surrounding islands off the coast of Sierra Leone. Zainab Masare is a senior WFP program assistant.
For them to have access to market, they have to use boat, and then they go to like Freetown and the other main markets that are within the country in order to be able to sell their products and buy food. But with the Ebola situation, this has been put to a stop. They cannot travel. And in fact, like the fishes they have, which they have already caught from the sea, cannot be sold for them to have exchange of food. So with this, the need is really there, because if they cannot go out to market to buy, how can they have access to food? So on that basis, there is need for us to give them food so that whilst they have this food, they will be able to think properly, and then the situation being addressed can get access to market.
Zainab Masare, a senior WFP program assistant. Britain's Prince William meets today with U.S. President Barack Obama at the White House. The future King of England is expected to speak with the president about the illegal wildlife trade. After his meeting with Mr. Obama, William will deliver a major speech at the World Bank. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On December 8th, 65 BC, the Roman poet Horace was born in southern Italy. In 1542, Mary Stuart, known as Mary Queen of Scots, was born. Mary would eventually lay claim to the crowns of Ireland and France. But when her claim to the English crown threatened Queen Elizabeth I, Mary was imprisoned and eventually beheaded. On this day in 1660, in a production of Shakespeare's Othello, Margaret Hughes starred as Desdemona in a groundbreaking performance. It was notable because she was the first woman to act on the English stage. Before that, boys played all of the female roles. On this day in 1813, one of the world's best-loved pieces of music debuted. Ludwig van Beethoven's Seventh Symphony premiered in Vienna. In 1854, Pope Pius IX proclaimed that Mary, the mother of Jesus, was conceived free of original sin. This Roman Catholic teaching is known as the Immaculate Conception. In 1941, President Roosevelt gave his famous Day of Infamy speech to Congress, calling for a declaration of war against Japan for its surprise attack on the American fleet at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. Also in 1941, Japanese forces invaded Malaya, Thailand, Hong Kong, the Philippines, and the Dutch East Indies. In 1974, a plebiscite formally abolished Greece's monarchy. The already exiled King Constantine II had left the throne the year before when a military junta effectively ended the monarchy. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Gender-based violence is one of the world's most pervasive human rights abuses. According to the World Health Organization, 35% of women have experienced either intimate partner violence or non-partner sexual violence in their lifetime. More than 130 million girls and women have experienced female genital mutilation and cutting. Gender-based violence takes far too many forms, from physical, sexual, and psychological abuse to female infanticide, sex trafficking, and forced labor, so-called honor killings, to harmful traditional practice such as early and forced marriage and female genital mutilation and cutting. Each and every form is unacceptable. Each and every form of violence creates an enormous obstacle to gender equality, economic development, and true human progress. That is why the United Nations began the annual observance of 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. Beginning with the observance of International Day to End Violence Against Women on November 25th and ending on Human Rights Day on December 10th, the 16 days observance shines a spotlight on the violence endured by women and girls around the world and encourages both men and women, girls and boys, to fight for the changes needed to challenge the entrenched gender inequality in most societies. All over the globe, including at many American embassies, activists and concerned citizens have scheduled marches, marathons, and other public activism to promote gender equality and advance the rights of women and girls everywhere. Violence against women creates and maintains poverty, said Vice President Joe Biden in a written statement. It threatens peace. Perhaps most importantly, it degrades all of humanity. We all must work together to fight gender-based violence around the world and the abuse of power in all of its forms. Today, we join with the international community in renewing this commitment.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.